Daniel chapter 11. We spent our time this morning in Daniel 11, verses 1 through 35, a historical account of hundreds of years of history, all culminating in a man named Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. And this man was what we would call a type. A type of the Antichrist. Now, we have not yet covered types in our Sunday school lesson. It was intended that we would do that this morning. We will, in fact, cover types next week, Lord willing, in our Sunday school lesson. And in doing so, we'll get a better idea of why it is that Antiochus the Fourth, Antiochus Epiphanes, may be considered a type of the literal fulfillment, of the complete fulfillment of the prophecy in Daniel 11, as well as that in Daniel chapter 8, and in part in Daniel chapter 9, of the man we know as Antichrist. You are now in Daniel chapter 11. I'd like you to keep your finger there, and let's turn, if you would, please, to Matthew chapter 24. Matthew chapter 24. We're going to begin this evening's service with a little bit of context going into why it is we can safely infer that Daniel 11, beginning in verse 36, is talking about someone other than Antiochus Epiphanes. There is not a clean break here, as there are in many prophecies, that would indicate to us that we are changing from one man to the other. However, we have some indicators, particularly things in these last few verses, these last nine verses, that do not mesh with the history as we see it in Antiochus Epiphanes. As with most things in theology, there are those that argue both ways. Some will say that this entire passage, Daniel 11, 1 through 46, completely, or through 45, excuse me, completely applies to Antiochus Epiphanes. There will be others that say it applies to both Antichrist and Antiochus Epiphanes. However, the historical record does not reveal some of these things to us, and so we are, as best we can, piecing it together. However, in Matthew 24, we see the basis for the principle of dual fulfillment in the prophecies of Daniel chapter 11 in regard to Antichrist as well as Daniel 8. Notice what it says in Matthew 24, beginning in verse 1. And Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said unto them, See ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be hewn down. That's the prophecy of 70 AD when the Romans came in and destroyed the temple. Same prophecy that we see in Daniel chapter 9. Verse 3, And he sat upon the Mount of Olives, and as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, Tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of thy coming, and of the end of the world? And Jesus answered and said unto them, Take heed that no man deceive you. For many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. And ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and pestilence and earthquakes in divers places. And all these are the beginning of sorrows. Then shall they deliver you up, speaking of the Jews here, the disciples, then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and ye shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And then shall many be offended, and shall betray one another, and shall hate one another, and many false prophets shall rise, and shall deceive many. And because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. But he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. Notice what he says, Jesus Christ speaking in verse 15. When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place. Whoso readeth, let him understand. Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. Let him which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. Neither let him which is in the field return back to take his clothes. And woe unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days. But pray ye that your flight be not in the winter, neither on the Sabbath day. For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not seen since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. As we consider what we read this morning in Daniel chapter 11, we recognize that Antiochus Epiphanes was in fact a fulfillment of that which we would call the abomination of desolation. Many years prior, he entered into the glorious land and he went into the temple and he sacrificed a pig upon the altar. Many years previous, he erected an image of Zeus in the temple. Sacrifices had ceased. He had performed the abomination of desolation in the temple in Jerusalem. And yet we get here to Matthew chapter 24, the time of Jesus Christ, well after the death of Antiochus Epiphanes. And after, well after the time that we have called the abomination of desolation. And as we consider this, recognize what Jesus says in verse 15. When ye therefore shall see, future tense, the abomination of desolation. What we understand here is Jesus Christ is painting the abomination of desolation as a future fulfillment, as a future event, well after the death of Antiochus Epiphanes. And what do we understand from this? And notice what Matthew places into the text in Matthew chapter 24, verse 15. Whoso readeth, let him understand. Matthew was writing the book of Matthew to the Jews, painting a picture of Jesus Christ as the King of the Jews. And what he is doing here is making a clear reference, a clear indication that though Antiochus Epiphanes did in fact cause the abomination of desolation in the temple, yet the complete fulfillment of the prophecies in Daniel was yet to come. And Jesus Christ is referencing the 7 years of tribulation, the end of the world. He, in fact, coins the term in verse 21, the great tribulation, referring to those final 3.5 years of tribulation. And so we see dual fulfillment, a prophetic event prophesied of and fulfilled in history in the person of Antiochus Epiphanes, yet fulfilled again and in its more full and realized context in the person of Antichrist. One more passage before we go back to Daniel chapter 11. Turn with me please to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, Paul writing to the church of Thessalonica, a church in need of comfort. And he writes to them concerning this man that will come. The man who will perform the abomination of desolation in the temple in Jerusalem during the time of the tribulation. The man we know as Antichrist. Notice what he says beginning in verse 3. Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first, and that the man of sin, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God, or that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Remember ye not that when I was yet with you I told you these things, and now ye know what withholdeth that he might be revealed in his time. For the mystery of iniquity doth already work, only he who now letteth will let until he be taken out of the way. And then shall that wicked, capital W wicked, shall that wicked be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth, and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming, even him whose coming is after the working of Satan, with all powers and signs and lying wonders, and with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish, because they receive not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. Thus Paul describes Antichrist, describes him in verse 3 as a son of perdition, of worthlessness, of wickedness, calls him a man of sin. He calls him that wicked, the capital W, the King James translators designating the fact that they were interpreting wicked to be his name, to be who he was, not just a description. When that wicked is revealed, a man whose literal name is wicked, a man who in verse 9 is after the workings of Satan. That's a little taste, a picture of the man that we are talking about this evening. The man that was typified in Antiochus Epiphanes and revealed in Antichrist. Please turn back with me to Daniel 11. We finished this morning with a picture of Antichrist in the end. Daniel chapter 11 verse 35 says, "And some of them understanding, and some of them of understanding shall fall, to try them and to purge and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed." We finished this morning with an idea of a time yet appointed, calling, looking forward to a time of the end. With that in mind, I would like us to understand a few characteristics of the Antichrist tonight. We're going to look at the character of the Antichrist. We're going to look at the policies of the Antichrist and finish with the projector, Lord willing, with the events surrounding Antichrist. Look with me, if you would, at the character of Antichrist, beginning in verse 36. "And the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished. For that is determined shall be done. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any god, for he shall magnify himself above all." We see first of all that he is a man of superfluous blasphemy, of great blasphemy, verse 36. Blasphemy is defined in this way in Webster's 1828. "An indignity offered to God by words or writing, reproachful, contemptuous, or irreverent words uttered impiously against Jehovah. An injury offered to God, or denying that which is due and belonging to Him, or attributing to Him that which is not agreeable to His nature." To blaspheme God is literally to speak words in falsehood, to speak words against Jehovah God. And as we recognize what we are seeing here, we are seeing a man who will exalt himself and magnify himself above every god. He has defiant self-sufficiency. Antichrist is defined as a man who finds his ends in himself. Not only will he withhold any credit for his life and for his existence from God, but he will deny glory to anything outside himself. He will even deny glory to other gods. He will deny glory to anything that is not himself. He holds to the epitome of what we would call today humanism, regarding everything, anything, as a product of what he has generated within himself. He's a man of complete blasphemy, complete defiant self-sufficiency. Antichrist is a man of contemptuous slander, beyond what I would deem to be called passive humanism, a man who sees his ends in himself but kind of keeps it to himself. Antichrist will be, in his own eyes, the end-all. He will be engaged in what I would refer to as active humanism. I would define active humanism this way: that quality in a man whereby his pride and self-exaltation give way to open contempt for the clear reality of Jehovah God's existence and sovereignty. So whereas a passive sovereignty says, "Okay, I am all that is. I am the end all. I am me." Excuse me, the passive humanism. "I am the end of all things. It's me." Passive humanism. And active humanism says, "Because I am the end of all things, I openly show contempt for the reality of Jehovah God." And that is who the Antichrist is. He will be a man, and as a man, he will follow that Romans 1 template of the man who has seen God through creation, knows of God's existence through his conscience, and yet he has denied God and exalted himself so vehemently that he cannot do anything but scorn Jehovah God with every breath. A man who has a contemptuous, slanderous loathing for the God of heaven. To a man that has reached extreme levels of self-exaltation and self-sufficiency, scorn and contempt for the Creator God is not simply an outlet. It is a must. The only way they can maintain such a self-sufficiency, the only way they can maintain such self-pride, is to openly and actively give a loathing for Jehovah God. The truth of God is so evident that such levels of blasphemy are necessary. Antichrist will be one in a long list of men who have fallen so deep into personal pride that they feel compelled to blaspheme God with their every breath. Such was the legacy of men like Friedrich Nietzsche, a man who saw himself in the line of what he called supermen, a man who wrote a book called Antichrist, where his longing in life was that he could be that man, the Antichrist. A man who saw his every purpose in life to degrade Jehovah God and to lift up the Superman, a super race of men free from defect, where anyone who did not meet his standard would be slaughtered like pigs. A man who, in turn, had great ties to Adolf Hitler. And men continue today in such a vein. A man named Richard Dawkins, perhaps you're familiar with the name, who slanders the God of heaven openly in the media, wrote a book called The God Delusion, where he penned these words about the God you and I serve. The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it. A petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak. A vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser. A misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully. See, there's a man who uses words that he may not even know the definitions of in order to try to give some weight to what he was trying to say. He said this about the God of the Bible. He's not going to be happy one day. He's probably not happy now, but he's not going to be happy one day. There is a line of men. There always has been a line of men, and there always will be a line of men like Friedrich Nietzsche, like Richard Dawkins, men who blaspheme the name of God openly, contemptuously. And Antichrist will be one of them. Antiochus Epiphanes was one of them, certainly not to this degree. And these men, I don't think they'll even hold a candle to that which Antichrist will be, to the way in which he will lift himself up. Antichrist was a man of superfluous blasphemy. Verse 37, he's a man of absolute pride. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall magnify himself above all. He will disregard the God of his fathers. This is where discrepancies start to creep into Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes' entire tirade in Jerusalem was an attempt to make sure that the God of his fathers, the Greek gods, were established in the land. He got rid of anything that was not in line with the Greek god system. That is why he erected a statue of Zeus in the temple, because he worshipped the Hellenistic gods of the Greeks, and he wanted the rest of the world to do so as well. So Antiochus Epiphanes would be a man that it would be hard to say that he did not regard the God of his fathers. Yet Antichrist is definitely understood to be a man, based on this passage, that could be such a man. A man of such pride that he would disregard any god except himself. Now there is some controversy regarding the implications of this statement. The phrase God of our fathers is often used connected with Jehovah God in Scripture. And as we understand that God of our fathers tends to be connected with Jehovah God, there are many people that say, that state, that assert that Antichrist will therefore be a Jew. He will therefore come out of the Israelite nation, and that for him to disregard the God of his fathers would be to disregard Jehovah God. I suppose it is a possibility. However, we also know from Revelation 13:1 that he will be from the sea. He will be from the Gentile nations. And we know that the people of the Antichrist is known as the Roman people. Because in Daniel's prophecy in Daniel chapter 9, it says that the people of the Antichrist will destroy the temple. And we know from AD 70 that the Romans destroyed the temple. And so the people of the Antichrist have to be Rome, the Western world system, I suppose. And he definitely comes out of the sea. So unless he was a Jew that happened to be born in Rome and coming out of that system, it does seem somewhat unlikely that he will be a Jew. It is possible, however, we can't exactly know. But that's what many people have said, that because of this phrase, the God of our fathers, he will be a Jew. Now it also says here, he will not regard the desire of women. Again, the specific meaning of this passage is a little bit ambiguous. In 2 Samuel 1:26, David uses the term the love of women to describe the affections of a woman. That love and that mercy that are characteristic of a woman. So some people have said that the fact that he will not have the desire of women means that he will not have any love, mercy, or affection found in him at all. Others have taken it more literally and said that the desire of women is literally the fact that he will reject anything but himself, and so that he will even reject that natural male desire for a wife. That's possible as well. Now we know that that could not apply to Antiochus Epiphanes, as he was a man of cruelty, but he was a man who definitely did not reject the desire of women in the literal sense. One of two things, however, is certain. Either Antichrist will be characterized as a man that is so self-sufficient and in such denial of his very human nature that was born into him by God, that he has rejected even that desire for the opposite gender that is healthy in a male unto marriage, or he will be a man characterized by a cold, calculating personality that rejects any affection, love, or mercy. For all that, it might be both. We're not quite sure, but what we know is this is not a good man that's being described here in Daniel 11:36 and 37. Either way, Antichrist will be a man driven by pride, self-love, and self-sufficiency. Now, I'd like us to pause before we go on to our second point this evening. Let's just camp on this idea for a moment. Antichrist will be a man driven by pride, self-love, and self-sufficiency. And he is the man known as the Antichrist. Indicative in his name is the very reality that what he is directly opposed to what Christ is, correct? Antichrist. Anti meaning against, Christ being the Messiah. He is everything that Christ is not. Yet I've already mentioned these characteristics of self-sufficiency, self-love, and tremendous pride are not foreign to the human existence. And folks, they're not foreign to our hearts either. Self-love, pride, self-sufficiency are characteristics that are often found in our hearts as well. But what we must understand is that the exhibition of these characteristics in our lives, without any doubt, are anti-Christ. Without any doubt, the exhibition in our lives of pride, self-love, and self-sufficiency, to whatever degree they exhibit themselves in our lives, is not formed in Christ. Because they will be found in Antichrist. You know, we live in a society that tells us that we are everything we need. We live in a society that says that in you, in yourself, you have all that you need to be successful, to be happy, to be healthy. Follow your heart. You are whatever you decide you want to be. Build yourself up. We live in a society that incessantly insists that there is no God, and that any self-respecting person would not give glory to an imaginary being that, in fact, should be given to one's own self. You're beautiful. You are everything you need. Find worth in yourself. And when you hear such rhetoric, and when you see the seeds of self-sufficiency and pride creep into your heart as you hear people say such things, remember Daniel 11. Remember that the same words will flow freely out of the mouth of a man known as Antichrist, a man who is characterized as everything that God is not. And ladies and gentlemen, guard yourselves against pride, against self-love, and against self-sufficiency. Because that is what will characterize the man who is against Christ in every facet of his existence. Antichrist. Thus we have seen the character of Antichrist, verse 36 and 37. Verse 38 and 39, let's consider the policies of Antichrist. The policies of Antichrist. First, in verse 38, he is a man of tremendous greed. But in his estate shall he honor the God of forces, and the God whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. He will be a man characterized by tremendous greed. He will honor what is said here to be the God of forces. Literally, if you were to look at that, if you were to look up that word, the God of forces, it would be literally translated the God of strongholds. Now, we already know from verse 37 that he regards not the God of his fathers, or for that matter, any God, nor regard any God. So what does it mean here that he would worship the God of forces if he doesn't regard any God? Well, if we extrapolate the true meaning, that he will worship the God of strongholds, of forces, of that which is strong. What we extract from that is the fact that Antichrist, it's not that he will worship a particular deity, but rather his entire focus of his life will be to increase his own wealth and his own power. He will worship the God of strongholds. He will be a warmonger. He will be a man of greed. And he will sacrifice gold and silver and precious stones and pleasant things. What does that mean? He will give of all that he has to gain more. He's going to be a man of tremendous greed. 39, he will be as well that warmonger. Thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange God, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many, and shall divide the land for gain. One of the primary ways in which this man's greed will manifest itself will be through a spirit of warmongering, far opposed from Jesus Christ, known in the book of Isaiah as the Prince of Peace. Antichrist will be a man consumed with conquering, consumed with war. And those who quickly and readily pledge their allegiance to him will be rewarded with great riches and land. And that's the implication of the end of that verse. And he shall cause them to rule over many, and shall divide the land for gain. The men that will turn to his side, that will be a part of his system, that will bolster his power, will be greatly rewarded with riches and with land. Let's finish up this chapter as we look at verses 40 through 45. Not just the character of the Antichrist, not just the policy of the Antichrist, the man of great greed and warmongering, but let's consider the events surrounding Antichrist. I will now switch to your page that you have there, and the page that you should be looking at is the one that has this on top. 2 Thessalonians 2:3, Revelation 13, the covenant between Israel and the prince that shall come. Let me read verses 40 to 45 for you. I'll just read verse 40 for now. We'll get to the other ones in a minute. And at the end At the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter into countries and shall overflow and pass over. We know already from Daniel 9, verse 20 to 27, that Israel will enter into a false covenant with Antichrist that assures them 7 years of peace. That's Daniel 9:27. This peace is so strong that as we look in the book of Ezekiel, as the king of the north is coming against Israel, they don't even have fenced cities. This peace is so strong that they are living outside of walls, outside of fences, outside of barricades. Right now, if you go to Jerusalem, you will see barricades, you will see walls, you will see fences. They won't have them anymore. They will be so secure in their land because of this great peace treaty with the West, with Antichrist, with the Western world, that they will have no fear. That is substantiated in Ezekiel 38, verses 8 and 11, that they are living in a time without fear, as you see on your sheet, a time of unprecedented peace due to the false covenant with Antichrist. And this covenant will last the first 3.5 years of the tribulation. Antichrist, at the beginning of the tribulation, has not yet assumed power over most of the world. There are, in fact, at this point, 4 world powers, as we see in a combination of understandings with the book of Revelation, with the book of Ezekiel, and the book of Daniel. There is Rome, the Western world, over which Antichrist rules. There is the North Coalition, known in Ezekiel as Magog, and it is led by a man named Gog. Gog of Magog, and this is often understood by conservative scholars to be the nation of Russia. It is a place situated north of Israel, and it is generally understood to be Russia. Now, the North will also have a league, and we'll talk about that in a moment, and we'll try to make this a little bit more interesting for us. There will also be a southern coalition. This southern coalition is known as Cush in Ezekiel. It's made up of Sudan, Egypt, Ethiopia, and then Put. Cush and Put. And Put is, as we look at the ancient understanding and the ancient labels, Libya. And there will be a 4th world power. So you have the Western world, you have the Northern Coalition, which is in fact Russia, Iran, and Iraq. You have the Southern Coalition of Egypt, Sudan, Ethiopia, and Libya. And then you have an Eastern Empire. This Eastern Empire, there's not much spoken of regarding them in scriptures, except that the kings of the East will come against Antichrist in the last days. We'll talk about that next Sunday morning. And at that time, this Eastern coalition, probably Asiatic countries, potentially India, most likely China, and potentially the Koreas, we're not quite sure. North Korea may end up siding with Russia because they have a good treaty right now. We don't know. But there will be some kings of the East that will also have some measure of power in the world. Probably somewhere near the 3.5 year mark, there will be this king of the north, Gog of Magog, probably, possibly, potentially Russia. We can't know that for sure. And then certainly he will be confederate with Persia. It says that Gog of Magog will be confederate with Persia in Ezekiel 38. And that confederacy with Persia, Persia being that area that is now Iran and Iraq. Now, this should ring somewhat interesting to you if you've been reading the news. Because Russia has just come out in the United Nations in the past 2 weeks and said, if you pick on Iran, you pick on Russia. If you start a war with Iran, you are starting a war with Russia. And every time there's UN sanctions that are trying to go against Iran for their nuclear programs, Russia immediately vetoes any sanctions against Iran. They have a very, very strong alliance right now. It's an alliance that goes all the way back to former rulers of their countries, and it doesn't look like that alliance is going to break anytime soon. And if we follow Scripture to its end, we recognize that whoever Gog of Magog is, if it is Russia, in fact, they are in league with those nations that at the time were Persia, now known to be Iran and Iraq. And so it does fit together. Now, is it clear? Not 100%. We can't know for sure that Gog of Magog will be the leader of Russia and that Magog will in fact be Russia. But it makes sense. With geography, with what's happening in the Scriptures, it could also be Syria. Syria is to the north, and it would make more sense in the context of Daniel chapter 11. But in many ways it seems unlikely based upon the geography as you look in Revelation and as you look in Ezekiel chapter 38. And so we have this confederacy, the king of the north, Gog and Magog, and then he confederates with Persia, with Cush, and with Put, and they invade Israel while she is defenseless. They invade her for her wealth, and they go down and they say, we will invade while they are defenseless. In Ezekiel 38:21 through 39:8, we see that, in fact, at this time, somewhere probably just near that 3.5 mark of the tribulation, as Gog of Magog and his confederates are traveling down to Israel to destroy it, there will be great catastrophes, earthquakes, fire will fall from heaven. In the confusion, the various nations will turn on each other and attack one another, and Gog of Magog will be in large part destroyed. The Scriptures tell us in Ezekiel 38 and 39 that in fact one third of that army is able to return to Magog. However, at the same time that Gog of Magog and his armies were coming down to destroy Israel, and the armies from the south were moving up to destroy Israel, while God is sending supernatural earthquakes and fire from heaven to destroy that army, He is as well bombarding Magog, and the entire nation of Magog is destroyed by fire from heaven. And so they get back to find the nation entirely destroyed, judged by God for their attempt to destroy Israel. Magog has been destroyed. The coalition, particularly the northern half, is now destroyed. However, the southern half of this coalition is still in existence. And that brings about our next series of events found in Daniel 11:41 through 44. Scriptures say, "And he shall enter into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape, but he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. But tidings out of the east and the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy, and utterly to make away many." Probably somewhere near the 3.5 year mark of the tribulation, the king of the north is stirred to attack Israel. He's destroyed. Antichrist will come onto the scene, since these nations have tried to attack Israel. And after all, Antichrist has a covenant with Israel. There's a treaty in place. So Antichrist stands up and he goes to defend Israel. An attack on Israel is seen as an attack on the Western world. So Antichrist stands up to defend them. He will begin a campaign against Egypt and the south, and he will destroy all with the exception of Edom, Moab, and Ammon. Those nations will escape from his hand. What are those nations today? We don't quite know what nations those would be today. Large parts of Iraq were where Edom and Moab were, so perhaps Iraq will not be a part of that confederation, and perhaps Iraq will be a part of that which will be spared, and Iran is the part that's mentioned in Persia. We're just not quite sure. We can't be quite sure because of the use of old names, not new demarcations. But what we do know is Antichrist will come down and he will use this opportunity, this attack against Israel, to begin sweeping the enemies of Israel, sweeping through Egypt, conquering these lands. And at some point, probably during this southern campaign, which you see there on your page, the southern campaign may go beyond the 3.5-year mark. Sometime during this southern campaign, at the 3.5-year mark, Antichrist will turn on the nation of Israel. He will place himself upon the throne in Israel at the 3.5-year mark. Look at verse 45. And he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious, holy mountain. Yet he shall come to an end, and none shall help him. So really, the 3.5 years are not, the last 3.5 years are not mentioned here. What we see in this last bit of Daniel chapter 11, before we transition into the second half, 3.5 years, which is in Daniel 12, we see him erecting himself in the temple on the holy mount between the two seas, the Mediterranean and, of course, that sea, the Galilee, the Jordan River, all of those, the demarcations there. And then it says, he shall come to an end. And his end is coming in that second 3.5 years. And this is where we end today, at the beginning of what is known as the Great Tribulation, the end of the first 3.5 years of the 7 years of tribulation, where Antichrist places himself upon the throne. The northern coalition has been destroyed. They're not a problem anymore. The southern coalition is currently being destroyed. They're not a problem anymore. Antichrist and the Western world has destroyed the northern king, is destroying the southern king. That leaves two world powers remaining, the Western world and the kings of the East. And we'll see what happens next week between the Western world and the kings of the East. And of course, the end of Antichrist as we know it. As we close, I would like us to reflect again upon the application that we made halfway through. This particular chart, we'll finish up next week. Be sure to bring your charts again. But let's remember the Antichrist to be a man of tremendous pride, self-love, and self-sufficiency. When we see those elements creep into our own lives, when we see pride, self-love, self-sufficiency in society, know that those are the characteristics of the man that is known as the Antichrist, the one in whom you are, the one in whom your entire life is dedicated to serving. Those elements of the human existence, pride, self-sufficiency, self-love, are against everything that Christ is. Let's allow that to ring in our hearts as we close this evening.